I do believe that the human being is a technical being, that we have always been so. I think it's really important to see that in order to have a good societal ethical discussion about ourselves and about the future of our society in interaction with technologies.
This is Future Based Podcast with your host, Sabine Winters.
In my work, I try to show that the relation always needs a medium to take place in. It's not something vaguely spiritual. It doesn't take place in a vacuum. It's basically technologies that we use that connect us to the world around us.
Future Based is an interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary, postdisciplinary, or whatever you want to call it, philosophy platform. Not only do we share podcasts and articles, but we also organize discussions, reading groups, meetups, gatherings, performances, and everything in between. Because there's this tendency to forget the importance of reflecting on how the world is changing, and in particular what the consequences of these changes might be. And as paradoxical it might sound, familiarizing ourselves with the future grants access to a better understanding of the now. If you want to know more about Future Based, please visit futurebased.org.
I think philosophy is of utmost importance here, because I think we are discovering ever more that the societal developments that we are facing now, also the societal challenges, totally move beyond disciplines. It's not just multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary, it's basically something like transdisciplinary or postdisciplinary.
Peter Paul Verbeek is Distinguished Professor of Philosophy of Technology and Co-Director of the Design Lab of the University of Twente, the Netherlands. He's also an Honorary Professor of Techno-Anthropology at Aalborg University of Denmark. His research focuses on the philosophy of human-technology relations and aims to contribute to philosophical theory, ethical reflection, and practices of design and innovation. In this extra long podcast, Peter Paul will shed his light on various topics ranging from our relationship with technology, technology and creativity, to object-oriented ontology and metaphysics, and the importance of philosophy and exploring boundaries between science fiction and reality. But let's start at the beginning.
So we are in the design lab of the University of Twente, and within the design lab we are in the philosophy lab, my own little place within the design lab, my home base, you could say, one of the two, because I also have a home base in our philosophy department actually. And the design lab is the place at the University of Twente where we try to connect science and society, and to integrate societal, ethical questions and reflections with, well, the design of new devices, machines, artifacts, new technologies. So my own role here in the design lab is that I'm one of the three scientific directors. The design lab is run by five people, actually. General director, Sabine Wildevuur, and operation director, Mirjam Iliohan. And then there are three scientists, three full professors that all focus on the interactions between humans and technologies. Vanessa Evers, a professor in social robotics. Marcia van der Voort, a professor in human-centered design. And myself, a professor in the philosophy of human-technology relations. All three elements are important. The engineering part, the design part, and the societal part, you could say. Mm-hmm. It's all important to understand how our society is changing through technology, and also how we can feed that back into design to make better and more responsible technologies.
How to understand the relations between technology and being human or human beings? And why is it important to question ourselves about the relationship we have with technology? This might be preaching to the choir, but why is philosophy important when it comes to exploring the relationship between man and technology?
I think philosophy is of utmost importance here, because I think we are discovering ever more that the societal developments that we are facing now, also the societal challenges, totally move beyond disciplines. It's not just multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary, it's basically something like transdisciplinary or postdisciplinary. And as soon as such questions pop up, I think there's a lot of room for our field in philosophy, because suddenly you have to rethink the basic notions that are at stake, right? It's really about the quality of life, it's about responsibility, but also things like agency, As soon as you develop an algorithm or a robot that starts to be involved in, I don't know, making a diagnosis or caring for people, then what does it mean to be an agent? And if an agent has responsibility, what can responsibility mean for a robot or for AI or something? And so all the concepts with which we have been thinking need to be, well, rethought, as it were. So it's really a great, how do you say, playground for our field. Yeah.
It seems that we are used to ask questions that have set boundaries already in them, and perhaps asking questions is inevitably linked to setting boundaries. For example, questions on how we should interact with nature are asked from a point of view that nature, like technology, is something that we can distance ourselves from. But in reality, the boundaries aren't that clear, if there even are boundaries at all. Because we are nature, we are technology. Is this human nature and human technology debate somewhat the same?
Yeah, I think that's quite a nice comparison. In a sense, you can even say that in the domain of philosophical anthropology, the field of philosophy that tries to understand what it means to be human, both elements have been very important. So I think the whole field came into being in reply to the theory of evolution. So in the old idea, humans were God's creation, and now suddenly we're just an animal, more like an ape than we're like God, right? And that was, of course, something that required a lot of reflections. What does it then mean to be human? And interestingly, in understanding evolution, people also discovered that we are also to be demarcated and also linked to technology. And so one of the most influential theories in early philosophical anthropology is from Leroy Gourand, a French anthropologist, whose theory is that the most central feature of the human is that we started to walk on two legs rather than four, which gave us hands. An animal has to take everything it wants to hold in its mouth, but we can use our hands. Mm-hmm. And he says that even the development of the brain stems from the fact that we have hands, because those hands were only meaningful when we could use tools, make tools, have the creativity to make tools, have the language to speak to others and explain what we could do with the tools, to have memory that we still know what we can do with the tool. And so it shows that the development of the human being then went hand in hand with the development of technologies, even up to the physical level of us starting to cut and cook our food, change the ways in which our intestines function, etc. That even at the biological level, we are fully technical beings. We are not an animal with something extra, with reason or with language, but we are an animal from which something is lacking. We don't have a thick fur, so we need fire to stay warm, etc. And that's why humans and technologies have always developed hand in hand. So nature and also the world of material things are both the context within which we can be human in the first place.
What does it mean to be human in relationship with technology? And how do you give meaning if this meaning and reference is always changing?
I think behind the question, a very philosophical remark, is already an idea of what it means to be human. And that being in control, being autonomous, is the highest value, the highest thing to achieve. Typically then, life becomes a matter of trust. And there is a lot of suspicion, distrust. And that's, of course, also a very big theme in Freud's work. I'm not a Freudian, by the way. But it's interesting to look at the human being also through that lens, I think. And well, in that sense, you could say that the approach that I take is much more of a Nietzschean, if you want to link it to a thinker. Also, I would never call myself a Nietzschean. But what I like about Nietzsche is this idea, on the one hand, that we need to be understood as the outcome of evolution. So we need to take those scientific theories very seriously in our thinking. And on the other hand, that he believes that what is the most important thing for a human being is to have the guts to put yourself at stake. So his notion of the overman, the Übermensch, is a horrible word in German because it has got linked to the fascists.
Which of course
it's totally not what Nietzsche wanted. But the overman means it's a being that's always in development. It's a being that's always designs itself, as it were, to say it very much like you would do in this engineering context, in this design lab where we are now. to be human means to design yourself, to shape yourself, which is also the core of existentialism, I think. We are free. We are doomed to be free. We cannot do otherwise. If you deny that, then you deny your humanity, right? So it means there's always this abyss in front of you because you will develop, you don't know where you will go to.
There's Nietzsche.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, that's Nietzsche. And that's what he calls amor fati, love your fate. I think technology is our fate in a sense. I mean, you can be against it, but that doesn't make much sense. You can also not be against language or against gravitation or something. Mm-hmm. It's just the condition of us. And it's a nasty one. That's why a philosopher like Bernard Stiegler in France calls it a pharmakon, with the old Greek word, with the double meaning of being a medication and a poison at the same time. It is a medication because we need something to survive, yeah, because we are basically deficient beings. And on the other hand, it's a poison because it makes us always inauthentic. It takes us from ourselves. We always are some kind of project for ourselves. We are ourselves, but we also have ourselves to design, as it were. Duality, I think you see very nicely in our everyday world of devices and technologies. So how to understand the intricate relations between humans and technologies? And indeed, I do believe that the human being is a technical being, that we have always been so. And why is that important? I think it's really important to see that in order to have a good societal ethical discussion about ourselves and about the future of our society in interaction with technologies. And too often ethicists try to demarcate humans from technologies, or technologies from humans, obviously, and try to somehow draw lines and boundaries. And there needs to be a red line, and this far, no further is where new devices can go. And I think that approach fails to see that also the human being that we are now is the outcome of earlier technologies, and that ethics should be much more about finding responsible ways to connect ourselves to new technologies than trying to find ways to keep all these technologies out. If you think about our own field of philosophy, we could not do this without writing, for instance. And the first philosophers, interestingly, who we can still read, were also thinking about writing. Plato was really hesitant about writing. He was really worried that we could not memorize anything anymore. Well, that has come true, in a sense. Our memories function differently than they used to do, I think. But we can also memorize much more if we include everything that is now in books and on hard disks in our idea of what memory is. We've extended our memory, as it were, to the material world. Well, if you then jump to the current day, artificial intelligence, I think, is now a technology much comparable to writing back then. It's a technology that works on the mind, on our thinking. It helps us to make sense of the world. And of course, people are now as hesitant towards this as Socrates and Plato were towards writing. What will happen? Will we lose something? I think that's an interesting sign that something very important is at stake, that we are in a new stage of the development of humankind. Right? And therefore, for me, the question would not just be, should we do it or should we not do it? Where should we and where should we never apply AI or something, which is very often the discussion. It's more about how can we find good and responsible ways to connect ourselves to artificial intelligence? What are the values at stake as soon as AI informs a doctor about the diagnosis, or AI informs a robot to care for people? If we understand what the values are that are at stake, then we can also take responsibility for these devices much better.
Speaking of values at stake, when we think about what it means to be human, something that really belongs to the realm of human beings, and maybe to some other animal species, is being creative, making art and music. But gossip has it that AI is slowly taking our seat when it comes to creativity. So this means that creativity be translated into an algorithm, maybe a very complex one, but still. Key question is then, can AI or can technology be creative?
Let me find a good answer. So asking whether AI can be creative or not,
it's a big question.
Yes, but yeah. Again, it's also a question about, can a technology be like a human? And will it ultimately outdate us? Or because if the computer can be creative, then what room is there for human creativity? And I think also in this case, I tend to see that as a mediation issue. So I would try to understand how AI has effects on what creativity is and means, right? And I could imagine a computer being able to generate zillions of varieties on something and maybe even copying kind of a path of associations that writers or novelists or painters or composers could follow, and that, it's, that it could mimic the process of creativity. But I think ultimately the value of a work of art is not just in that it is a nice outcome of creativity. That's like saying that the essence of a car is in the engine, but it's in that you can move with it or something. Eh? So art requires creativity, but it also requires meaningfulness. Yes. And it has a meaning. It makes a statement. It's, I don't know, critical or beautiful or awesome, literally. And I think we could be lucky and see a work of art generated by AI and then, see that it's very beautiful or inspiring. But as soon as it really tries to give a message, we cannot get in touch with the author of the artwork. Mm-hmm. As well. It's really hard to see it as a message because the message doesn't come from someone, right? Or we would reach a situation where AI becomes so good that it could analyze, the situation in the world.
The context.
And, yeah. And make some kind of a visualization that really inspires us because it shows new connections that we cannot oversee with our limited minds, and that makes us think. And then, I mean, I could totally imagine that to happen. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely a function that artworks can have as well, that it makes you see the world differently. But then I would not see that as a form of creativity unless you want to expand the notion and the meaning of the notion. I would say, well, then we are basically back to what technologies have always done. They have always changed how we understand the world. They are not neutral. They are not neutral tools. They're not just a pill that we take and then everything changes. They are impactful. What parenthood means changes through the birth control pill. What good care for elderly people means changes through the devices we have. How much pain we find acceptable changes through anesthetic devices. How we want to suffer at the end of our lives changes through means we have for euthanasia. So in that sense, technology has always been creative, in the sense that it has been the source of new frameworks of interpretation, just like artworks. It's also not for no reason that the old word techne meant both art and technology. I think also in the field of robotics, and that's also a core theme in my work, we need to be careful not to see technologies as a replacement of the human. And I mean, we have always made this mistake. For every new device that was invented, people were afraid of it because it would push the humans from the stage, as it were. So, and I think for a robot, it's quite natural that we think, okay, what will happen if a robot will keep an elderly person company, not a human? If a robot will do the surgery, not a human? But if you take a bit of a distance from the situation, the real question is, how will our social relations with elderly people change when we introduce robotics? How will healthcare change when we introduce robotics? And if you look from that distance, you can also say, okay, no one of us is 24/7 with their elderly parents. And they have a TV, they have books, they have ways to spend their time when there is no real human company. So why could not a robot be a new element of that? Knowing that it's not a human, it doesn't replace a human. It is just a very fancy way of spending your
reading
time.
Reading a book.
Yes, yeah, maybe. And that has become very old-fashioned already. I think for many people, not for a philosopher, I think. And in healthcare, I believe the same. I mean, if I give a talk, I often show a picture of a feeding robot who gives an elderly Japanese man some food. Or who? That, I should say. And most people, when they first see the picture, they are horrified. They think, oh, this is not a future we want. We want people to take care of people. You're such a vulnerable old man needs human care, not robot care. That's not real care. But funnily enough, well, not funny, but my own father at the end of his life could not eat anymore. So I have seen from nearby what it means for somebody to live like that. And he found it so degrading and humiliating that other people had to feed him. And so my mother could do it, obviously, my sister and me, one neighbor. If we were not there, he would just not eat. He found it too embarrassing to let someone feed him. Well, when I saw the robot, I thought, well, this is actually, it's so outdated to think that this is just a terrible way of keeping human care from a human being. Yeah. This would have been great for my father. He would have loved it because he would not need to undergo that whole humiliation. Here in our design lab, some people even made an algorithm with that robot for people who cannot operate it with their legs or their chin anymore. If you can do nothing, then still you want to eat in a group because you feel most lonely when you're sitting just all alone in your own room. Mm-hmm. So they made an algorithm that can follow the conversation at the table, and when there is a pause coming, then it gives a bit of food to the patient. Very basic algorithm. It's not so hard, I think. I'm not a coder, but this means that you can connect ethical values to the design of technologies, and that a robot can actually be very ethical and much more humane than letting humans feed humans.
So in this next part of the podcast, we slowly move from the ethical questions around robotics to the field of metaphysics, ontology, and the distinction between subject and object. Why should we even care about the object-subject relations and rethink the relations we have with objects around us?
But still, I think this underlines the importance of designing for values, yes, because those values are also cultural. So I could imagine that the culture of embarrassment can even be bigger in Japan. But what I also know is that it's much less hard for people from some Asian contexts to take robots seriously as actors. Because, I mean, we make that kind of neurotic distinction between the subject and the object, and the objects are dead and silent and mute, and the subject are active. And as soon as you blur the boundary, then you get punished for making a category mistake or something. In some Asian countries, there is a form of agency in things. And I think we call it animism, but that sounds like it's kind of a retarded way of thinking about things. It is not retarded. It's a way of showing respect. Basically, it's a culture of respect for everyone and everything. And that means that you have a much more fuzzy boundary between humans and things than we make in our Western culture. Mm-hmm. And it also gives a much more natural role to robots in societies. It's not for no reason that in Japan there are so many robots.
Yes, yes. And it has this link to I'm going a bit off topic, but has this a link to object-oriented ontology?
Probably.
Yes.
I mean, this is one of the fascinating developments that you see now. It's also approaches that cause a lot of discussion within philosophy.
Yes.
So I'm obviously in that field in philosophy where we try to rethink things, or to rehabilitate things in a sense, to give material objects, to use a very Western word, a more natural place in our thinking. And there are several approaches. Object-oriented ontology is one of them, starting really from the object, so trying to understand the world from the object,
yes,
which is, of course,
bridging the Kantian gap.
Yes. So indeed, for Kant, that's, of course, then our antiposition, because that's one big attempt to bridge the gap, but the gap was somehow created by himself by separating consciousness within us and the objective world outside. And then the question is, how can we possibly be sure that what we think in our minds connects to the world? Of course, this is a caricature of Kant, because I mean, I could also say that Kant is basically the one who started thinking about the whole relationality between humans and the world, which resulted in phenomenology and ultimately post-phenomenology, where I see myself being located. That's also a good thing to say. I mean, I've had a lot of discussions with Harman, Graham Harman, the main
really?
The thinker. Yeah, maybe you should interview him at some point as well.
Oh, maybe, yes.
But, I mean, the dispute seemed to be that, for me, ultimately, we should think about relations. I do not want to give up the distinction between the humans and the non-humans, the subjects and the objects, as people like Bruno Latour would do, mm-hmm, even though I have a lot of respect for his work, and it has inspired me. It keeps inspiring me a lot, maybe most of all. There's one thing in Latour that I find hard to swallow, and that is the symmetry principle. So the idea that we should treat humans and non-humans alike, as if there's only one. As soon as it has an impact, it's an agent, and that's enough. From a phenomenological point of view, I would say we experience ourselves as ourselves being in a world. Mm-hmm. There is some kind of a relation from us to the world around us. And that gives us a separation between subject and object, or human and world, whatever you want to call it. And my whole work is about showing that you can never have the one without the other. And that's actually what phenomenology has always said. Humans are always somehow related to the world. You cannot just see, you see something, you hear something. Eh? And the world in itself, it will probably exist, but we will never find out what it is in itself, because as soon as we ask a question about it, it's the world for us, as yeah. we have a relation with it. So you can never overstep the relation, right? And in my work, I try to show that the relation always needs a medium to take place in. It's not something vaguely spiritual. It doesn't take place in a vacuum. It's basically technologies that we use that connect us to the world around us. So I see technologies as mediators. As soon as we use a technology, it links us to the world around us. And in doing so, it makes the world meaningful for us, but it also constitutes what we are in relation to that world. So yeah, you could even say, first there is a relation, and then there are the relata, to say it very philosophically. Mm-hmm. So first there is a technology. Yeah? An example that I used in my book on the boundaries of the human, ultrasound, and there's a pregnant woman or couple and a fetus, an unborn child, and then you make an ultrasound. And of course, there is a pregnant woman and a fetus, but you can say as soon as you make an ultrasound, first there is this new relation, and then suddenly what it means to expect a child changes totally, because suddenly you become responsible for things that could be wrong, to say mm-hmm. it, with your child, and the child suddenly becomes a potential patient for whose life you might need to take responsibility. Yes. So everything changes. You change, the fetus changes, and even if you don't use ultrasound, the fact that we have it makes us responsible. Even not having a scan made has become a choice. Technologies are media. And so that is not object-oriented ontology in a sense, because for me it's about a relation. But the last discussions that I had with Graham Harman were typically about the fact that for him the objects are actually these relations. Because you can never, of course, think really from the objects themselves. So yeah, I mean, the furthest you can go to think about the relations. But this is actually, we spoke about a book that I'm still writing.
Oh, yeah.
So one of the chapters will be maybe very metaphysical. That will be about it. But this is, for me, the toughest thing to do. Because I feel very close, both to Latour and both to Harman, mm-hmm. and to other approaches, the whole new materialism approach that you see in the humanities as well. So it's... what I want to do is to empower this movement and also demarcate what I think is the most important line within it. But basically, I also want to keep up the idea that this is one movement that deserves, maybe a bigger place in our thinking.
Yes, because it's relative unknown within academic life.
Yeah, maybe it depends a bit on where you are in philosophy. <Yes. laughs> But definitely, I think people who have a stronger basis in analytic philosophy tend to attach more value to the subject-object distinction than people who are a bit stronger trained in continental philosophy. Now, I hate this distinction. I really like to see my own work as doing continental philosophy in an analytic way. If I give a PowerPoint presentation, then typically I've done it sometimes at rather hardcore continental conference, and they say, "Well, this is not philosophy. This is analytic philosophy."
Oh my God.
And yeah. I think the analytics would say, "Yeah, well, as soon as you mention Foucault, then I'm gone. Yeah, this is not philosophy." So it's kind of childish. Maybe there's no single field in the world that is so obsessed with demarcating what it is. Yeah? Yes. It's the worst thing you can say as a philosopher to somebody else: "This is not real philosophy."
It's ironic, isn't it?
Terrible. Yes. It is terrible. Yeah. it's a sign of insecurity. If you have such a big urge to define yourself, real philosophy, and so to feel the need to call other approaches not real, that's I've never really understood that urge. No,
and I think that's why you are where you are right now.
Maybe,
yeah.
Indeed, blurring the boundaries. Yes, no, indeed. And indeed, I could imagine people saying, well, is this real philosophy in a design lab? Shouldn't you do that in a philosophy department? Maybe. But I also do believe that the real new questions in philosophy have always come from new, well, social developments, technical developments. As we just discussed, philosophical anthropology was basically a reply to the theory of evolution. So I think our society is changing fast through new technologies.
Yes.
And being at a university where people are developing these things, artificial intelligence, gene editing, geoengineering, everything happens here. It's so inspiring to see what those people are thinking about and are doing. And it's also important to see that this is not just an alien world with weird nerds that are not thinking about society at all and they just do their engineering. That's often the image, or sometimes the people in the humanities have totally irresponsible nerds that, which is not the case at all, of course. These people are totally aware of the societal implication and they really want to think about that. And they even all typically want to make a better world and to contribute to more sustainability, etc. So that's also really inspiring to see that the old themes in philosophy about how to understand the world, how to make the world better, etc., they are also in engineering, and engineering also helps us to reconfigure the answers we could give to these old questions.
Designers, makers, thinkers, they all give shape to the world we are living in. What does this say about the responsibility of a maker, an author? Morality and creativity are in a constant flux because of the technologies are developing and changing constantly. What we should try to understand are the intricate connections between technologies and humans. What does this mean regarding the responsibility of makers for possible outcomes and unforeseen changes of new technological developments?
It means that makers always have to anticipate the potential societal implications of technologies. That's basically one of the key activities now in the ethics of technology, also what we do here in our design lab, which also is a complicated and maybe also a problematic thing in itself. So within ethics of technology, there's again a big discussion about how can you really take responsibility then when you design a new technology, because anticipating the future is, of course, not always a very scientific thing to do. You cannot somehow really make a good prediction of the future. You can't. Always unexpected things that happen. Humans use technologies in unexpected ways, give different meanings to it. So some people say we should see every design of a technology basically as a social experiment. Ivo van der Poel at Delft University of Technology, very nice colleague of mine, has this approach. So he says, since we cannot anticipate rationally, we should just make tiny little steps. See it as an experiment that we always, as well, like we do it in healthcare. Yeah, we do experiments on humans, but of course we are aware that we need to do this very, very, very carefully. So the same approach we should have in the ethics of technology. Small steps, see what happens, which I like in a sense, but the problem is that sometimes a technology is so disruptive that the small step is simply not available. Yeah. It's either jumping or nothing. And actually, when it is there, we have almost already made the jump.
Can you give an example?
Well, I think what you see at the moment with the gene editing.
Ah, yes.
And of course, yeah. So the technology is there. And it's actually quite doable to edit the genome of people. It is not very easy, but it's also not something that only two people in the world can do. And people have already been doing it for humans, right? So it is a very disruptive technology. We don't know what it can bring, but we cannot say, oh, let's do it a little bit and then see what happens. And then we know if we want it or not. No, it is there, right? Yeah. So we will have to learn how to deal with it. And that's why I also think we need bigger forms of anticipation. And that typically requires tools to trigger our imagination. And then the goal is not to make a prediction, well, this will happen or something. It's more to open a potential space so that we can have a good debate about what could be at stake.
Thought experiments?
Yes, that would be the analytic word for it. But I think it can even go further because... So, for instance, Challeng Swierstra, Maastricht University, another good colleague of mine in ethics of technology, works with what he calls vignettes. So he tries really to anticipate like a future 30 years from now and try to think radically through potential societal implications. Then it would say, okay, if we would have nanoparticles in our food that would somehow prevent the unhealthy stuff to get some processed by our bodies and we just poop it out again. And you could basically eat everything you want to eat and choose what will reach your whole metabolic system.
Yes.
Yeah. What would that do to the ways in which we take responsibility for eating? What would it do to the meaning of being overweight? If you do that, then of course you cannot make a prediction, but it's much like science fiction, but then maybe a more rational way of doing it. And I think that's what we need. I think even Günther Anders already said what we need is moral imagination. Use that.
Clouding, yes.
Good. No, in our field, we cannot do without it. And the easy reproach that it's not scientific, I couldn't care less. Because, of course, it would be really odd if you would claim that you have a scientific way to predict the future. Well, maybe in physics, you can predict how fast a particle will fall or something. But about society, this is simply not possible. Fortunately not. But that doesn't dismiss us from the responsibility to try as much as we can to take responsibility for the future that we might be creating with technologies.
And just like that, we ended up discussing my favorite topic in philosophy, the relation between science fiction and reality, and the field of speculative thinking and science fiction to explore new technologies and futures. Now, let's go a step further. You might have heard of the third pill of Slavoj Žižek, right? If you do not, and you are interested in films like The Matrix, you should definitely Google him. But for now, is there or is there not a real distinction between fiction and reality?
Of course, my question is based on Slavoj Žižek.
The third pill.
Yes.
The pill that makes you aware of the fact that your reality is actually fiction.
Yes.
Yes. So kind of a meta pill, a kind of a philosophical pill. Well, so... maybe the two things I want to say. It's going to be a long answer. I hope it's not a problem.
No.
So one thing is, I do believe that it's important to have a distinction between fact and fiction. I think if we totally give up on that, then we end up in a situation where it's really hard to keep a society together. And Hannah Arendt even said very nicely that the ideal subject of forms of totalitarianism are those people for whom the distinction between true and false does not exist anymore. We see what's happening now with the whole debate about disinformation, fake news, by which I totally do not want to claim that we should base policy on facts and nothing but the facts, because all facts are values as well. So I don't believe in neutral facts. So that's maybe the most important thing, first thing that I want to say. Facts and fiction come together in the sense that we always need interpretive frameworks to make sense of the world. So what a fact is for us, to say it in a very Latourian way, requires a lot of work to be a fact. It is not a self-evident thing that's true now and always. It is just something that has to be made true, as it were. And people have found this a terrible thing to say. Yeah, they've thought that he was a relativist, etc. And now very nicely he can show with the whole debate about climate change, well, look, this is what I meant. Everyone believes basically in science that the planet is warming up and it's because of human behavior. Mm-hmm. But we have to make this a fact, because there are people in the world who simply do not get this and who think we can just go on. So in that sense, the distinction between fact and fiction is both important and also a bit relative. But that third pill itself is a fictional thing that is totally misleading for me, because it really embodies for me the pill, the idea of a technology that is neutral, that doesn't mediate. So you take the pill and Everything changes. Yes. Yeah, so a pill suddenly makes you aware. That is the most dangerous fiction that we have in our society. Many people have this neutral idea of technology. It's just a tool. We have the goals. Technology is a neutral means, and we can change the world by using the tools in a responsible way. Mm-hmm. All the ethics is then in the user, not in the technology. And we fail to see that there is so much normativity in the tools that we make that we need to understand that and to shape that to have a better world.
Maybe we should take the red and the blue pill at once. That's something different.
Exactly. We'll be black then. Or whatever.
We can philosophize about that. I think why I'm asking this is because I think science fiction and analyzing science fiction is very, very important. For example, take Orwell, 1984. It's very much coming to life in our current society.
Yes.
But what technological developments are you looking forward to, or what sparks your enthusiasm?
Woo! I think from this Nietzschean mindset, it's always a combination of enthusiasm and also fear. Now, so, I mean, I've been obsessed over the past year with artificial intelligence because of my work for UNESCO to study the ethics of it on a global scale. And so I think that's a fascinating technology. I mean, we can say a lot about it. But the technology that I'm at the moment most fascinated but also frightened by is the technology of geoengineering. It's totally different. But, having walked around now for some time in the UN context at UNESCO, I've come to believe that this technology is going to be a major topic of discussion in the coming decade. Because the awareness of the disasters that are ahead of us is getting very big. And it's really terrible to see how fast the Earth is warming up. It goes much faster than we thought. So, I mean, you can try to deny it, but there will be disasters. There will be refugees. There will be serious conflicts between countries, I think, because of this. And I think the reflex people will have is to try to have an engineering way out. And then you can say, okay, we should never do this because it's megalomaniac. Maybe we cool down the Earth and maybe nobody can ever live here. And is it reversible? So I totally share those hesitations. So it's totally frightening. At the same time, the current heating of the planet is also induced by us. Right? So we have always influence, not always, but we have quite recently started to influence it at a very large scale. So how to think well about the possibilities we have, how to think about whose rights are at stake, whose vulnerabilities should be included, but also how we can have a democratic way of discussing this, who should be represented in the whole democratic process. Is it also the future generations? Is it also the interest of nature itself? A technology about one of the most pressing issues that humankind is facing at the moment. And the Earth, as Latour says it so beautifully, has never been questioned. It has always been the self-evident background for everything. And suddenly it starts to speak back. So this is not a cheerful story. Sorry for ending like this. But I still believe we should stay optimistic. I still believe that there are things we can do, and I also really believe that technology could play an important role here, but not just as a nice and fascinating engineering project, let some engineers solve the whole crisis. It's not as simple as that. It requires a lot of new frameworks, concepts, forms of inclusion, also the interests of people in the south of the world who are typically not even at the table when the engineers would think of doing this. In the context of world peace, future of humankind, I think this is the most fascinating technology. And I would hope for some good science fiction movies actually to help us explore what the potential futures could be.
Like Heraclitus once said, everything is change and everything flows. But it doesn't mean it's meaningless to go into dialogue with each other. On the contrary, reflecting and raising awareness about these changes in technology, for example, is the most important and valuable tool we have. And therefore, I would like to go into a bat for practicing philosophy.
for searching this interconnectedness and for blurring boundaries, maybe only to make them distinctive again, who knows? I want to thank Peter Paul Verbeek for this awesome interview, but also a thank you to you. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to know more or take a look at the show notes, please visit futurebased.org.